This is 68667. Is it Petroclusa?
Petulaski.
Thank you. First 8th JD. And counsel, if you're ready to go, please come forward. And if you wish to retain any time for rebuttal, please so state.
Thank you, Your Honors. Mike, may it please the court, Michael Mealy of Shimon Law from APC, on behalf of Aurora Petculescu, requests that this court reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Aurora is bringing this writ of mandamus seeking an order overturning the order denying defendant's motion for summary judgment, to overturn the order denying her motion for a writ of attachment, to rule as a matter of law that she's entitled to a writ of attachment, and to enforce her validly issued subpoenas. The basis for the writ is 4 points. The first point is Judge Smith's arbitrary and capricious standard of abandonment creates confusion, and if adopted, will further victimize people just as it has Ms. Petculescu. Second, defendant's motion for summary judgment should never have been granted because genuine issues of material fact still exist, and NRS 31.026 hearing is not dispositive of all causes of action, and Aurora has properly invoked NRCP 56F. Aurora is also entitled to a writ of attachment as a matter of law because this court can review statutes and interpret them. And lastly, Aurora's due process rights were violated by Judge Smith at the evidentiary hearing because he failed to enforce the validly issued subpoenas. He asked her questions on irrelevant matters that created bias. He limited the questioning of Aurora's counsel during the hearing, and he assisted defendants in laying the foundation for their exhibits during Aurora's chiefing case. The standard of abandonment adopted by Judge Smith is not the correct standard under Nevada law. Judge Smith's standard is that if the house is unlivable based on pictures, it must be abandoned. This is contrary to Nevada law. This court in Jensen v. Brooks ruled there can be no strict abandonment without the intention to do so. In Jensen, the court relied on direct testimony from the witness to determine the intent. Likewise, at the evidentiary hearing, Judge Smith heard three different witnesses all testify that Aurora never intended to abandon the house and, in fact, was residing at the residence the nights that she was locked out.
Now, what property was put in the dumpster of hers?
Her personal property. She had a list that I attached in the writ of attachment. She had couches, beds, mattresses, television.
We have, kind of as an aside, we have testimony that, yes, the personal property was placed in the dumpster, but it was in that dumpster, I think it was 20 or 30 days on the property.
Yes.
And there's no statement, whatever, that she came back, anything.
She did come back. She did testify that she came back the next day. They looked into the dumpster, and most of it was destroyed. She's a 61-year-old woman with rheumatoid arthritis, and it's not, she can't really dumpster dive, if I can use that. She didn't put it in there. Defendants have admitted to removing it out of there and placing it in there. Under the Judge Smith's standard of abandonment, his ruling for the motion for summary judgment can't be reconciled. He has deemed that she's abandoned the house and all personal property, but yet is able to maintain an action for trespass.
Right. First of all, I think we got the two issues, the attachment part of it, whether he should have issued the writ in the second summary judgment.
Sure,
so we have different standards of review on each of those. Let me ask this on the attachment. Let's say, assuming he had granted the attachment, I mean, your client would have to bond off the attachment. That could be pretty significant.
My understanding is that she wouldn't because she's filed a statement of legal aid representation and is not required to pay bonds.
On attachment bonds? Really?
On a statement of legal aid.
Okay. I mean, I've never seen that issue before, but so you're saying she could, if she would have got the writ of attachment, there's a law that allows her not to put the bond up.
My understanding, yes, is with the statement of legal aid representation, she's not.
Did she have that, though, at the time of the action before Judge Smith?
Yes. Yes.
The other question I have, or question, additional question, is was there a proffer made reference what the witnesses who were subpoenaed would have testified to?
The subpoenas were for documents. It wasn't for witnesses to appear.
Was there a proffer, though, as to what those would have shown?
No, there was not.
That creates a problem because normally when we look at that, we look at what was the harm. So it's important for us to understand what that would have shown.
There were instances during the evidentiary hearing where the witness that was asked to bring the documents could not answer questions and said he'd have to review the documents.
Okay. Now, on the 56F request,
yes.
How much time did your client indicate she needed to do her discovery to continue the hearing on the motion for summary judgment?
Discovery hadn't even started during when the motion for summary judgment was filed.
Okay.
So we didn't even get to the point.
So the main premise was you needed time to do discovery.
Exactly,
to
yes.
Show what issues of material fact.
Yes, and in fact, there were issues of material fact that day before the court. The pictures that Judge Smith relied on, defendants had initially testified at the evidentiary hearing, were taken on August 29th. That's a Friday. Aurora testified that she was locked out that day, but was able to get back into her house. The next day, August 30th, is when she left for the day and came back and was permanently locked out and found the dumpster full of her belongings. At that point, defendants then changed the testimony that the pictures were taken on August 30th. I'd also like to point out that defendants have admitted to destroying the electronic copies of these photographs. They don't contain a date or a timestamp. That fact was brought to light during the evidentiary hearing. And I believe that Aurora was entitled to at least an adverse inference, if not a rebuttable presumption, that those photos were taken after she was locked out and defendants had ample opportunity to destroy her house.
Okay.
Defendants to date have yet to argue the correct standard of abandonment. They have argued that because no one would live in such conditions of squalor, that the house must be abandoned. They've also argued a criminal law standard that she had no reasonable expectation of privacy. And most recently, despite having the correct standard of intent, they have chosen not to argue that and instead, in my opinion, have attempted to mislead this court into thinking that Judge Smith considered NRS 107.0795. That has never been argued before Judge Smith today, and it doesn't even apply. Next, the evidentiary hearing under NRS 31.026 is not dispositive of any issue other than determining whether a writ of attachment should issue. Judge Smith treated the evidentiary hearing as if it was dispositive on Aurora's conversion, wrongful eviction, punitive damages, and unlawful entry, when in fact the entire purpose of that hearing is to determine whether a writ of attachment should issue.
So you issued an order to show cause why a writ of attachment should not issue. Judge Smith had this hearing on it, and this is when all this transpired.
Well, actually, initially we filed the writ of attachment without notice under NRS 31.0173 and 5.
Okay.
Judge Smith decided that he wanted to have a hearing. At the hearing, Judge Smith incorrectly ruled that there had to be a nexus between Aurora and the property she sought to attach. We filed a writ of mandamus. This court granted the writ of mandamus and said that that is not a requirement and asked Judge Smith to actually rule on the conversion and whether defendants were attempting to dispose of property that could be used to satisfy a judgment.
Okay. And now you filed an answer to the complaint and then the other side filed a motion for summary judgment. This is conflated here, so I'm trying to understand what happened.
Sure. So we filed the complaint, and then defendants filed an answer.
Yeah.
We then filed a writ of attachment.
Okay.
Without notice, Judge Smith held a hearing.
Okay.
It was at that point that he ruled there must be a nexus. at which point we filed our first writ of mandamus before this court. This court granted it, sent it back for a rehearing. That hearing was the evidentiary hearing, lasted about 2.5 hours.
That was just for the attachment?
Yes, for the attachment.
Okay.
And then defendants filed a motion to dismiss, which was a motion for summary judgment. And
that was after the hearing?
After the hearing. And the sole basis of the evidence were these pictures and the testimony that they thought the house was abandoned, which in Winchell v. Schiff, this court has ruled that a good faith belief that property is abandoned is not a valid defense to conversion.
So the evidentiary hearing was not considered in any way to be a trial. It was simply on the attachment.
Exactly,
issue.
Yes.
Okay. So your argument is that regardless of what happened with the ruling on the attachment, there's still genuine issues of material fact that you need to explore, and that's why you filed the 56F affidavit?
Yes, that, and because defendants have, like I said, changed the date that the pictures were taken,
okay,
which if the second date was taken, falls in line with what Ms. Petkulewski testified.
Okay. I'm going to make sure we understand
anything
like that.
Counsel, you have 4 minutes.
I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Justices Douglas, Cherry, and Gibbons. Before I start, I'd just like to say how honored I am to be here today as a young practitioner. This is a very momentous occasion for me. And since I'm under
I hope you say that when we're done here, for both sides.
And just so it's clear, the record's clear, my name is Brian Nadafi, and I represent the defendant/real parties in interest, Debt Commercial Properties, LLC, and Andy Pham, an individual. Before the court today are 4 issues to decide on this writ of mandamus. Issue number 1 is, should this court enforce the subpoenas that were issued prior to the evidentiary hearing? Our evidentiary hearing for the writ of attachment was actually granted from a previously filed writ of mandamus and granted mandamus from this court. The scope of the hearing for the writ of attachment was twofold. Number one, it was to determine the probable validity of plaintiff's underlying claims. And after that probable validity, the next issue was if the defendants themselves were attempting to dispose of assets that would essentially make them judgment-proof. They're essentially trying to avoid being able to satisfy a judgment.
Did the petitioner here allege in her complaint that the foreclosure was wrongful, or was it the argument strictly the conversion argument on that person?
I believe there's a wrongful foreclosure claim in there. No formal foreclosure or no summary eviction matter was ever – not the foreclosure. I apologize, Your Honor. I'm confusing the two. No eviction, because our clients just purchased it as bona fide purchasers of good faith, but there is no wrongful foreclosure statement in there.
Okay, so that's now. So after the trustee's sale, and you had you got a hold of it. Did you get an order of summary eviction from the Justice Court?
No, there was no order for summary eviction from the Justice Court.
How did you get possession of the property?
It was a purchase, and upon seeing the property, after being given the ability to have title, so after title was filed, my clients went to the property. There were open doors. The garage door was open. Broken windows. Open the door to see no one in the property, hence possession started from that moment forward.
Okay. So your position is it was abandoned and you didn't need to get an eviction order from the court?
That is correct, Your Honor, but looking back now, I should have done the summary.
Okay, so what happened? So there was a lot of property, hot couches and stuff in the house, and your client put them in the dumpster there?
I believe there was maybe one or maybe two couches in the property. The idea was that it was a filthy, disgusting house. There was no water running to the house. There was a toilet stacked full of feces. There was no items for personal hygiene or toiletries. There was just nothing in there that would indicate anybody was actually living in the property. And the most damning piece of evidence for my clients was the fact that the doors that lead into the house were completely open. There's a garage door that's wide open, which essentially just says, welcome, come in.
Okay.
So back to the issue as to the subpoenas. So the scope of this hearing was to see if there was a probable validity of the claims, first and foremost. The subpoenas that were issued 3 business days before the evidentiary hearing were very, very grand in scope. They asked for, and I'm just going to quickly summarize here, tax returns, detailed asset lists, bank accounts, payroll, business records, accounting of funds, invoices, just a lot of different items. When the idea here, though, is to find out if there's a probable, either plaintiff's claims are probably valid, or the defendants are intending to move assets, these documents don't have necessary probative value.
So these documents were subpoenaed relating to the attachment hearing?
Correct. They were subpoenaed for the attachment hearing.
Okay.
So
and the judge quashed the subpoena?
No, the judge, Judge Smith, the Honorable Judge, Judge Smith, did not actually quash the subpoenas. He reserved judgment for later. I believe he stated that the requested documents were, quote-unquote, over the top. And the idea was that the court wanted to hear the testimony, and if any further documents were required, the court would ask for said documents. But there was never a decision made on quashing the subpoenas. So it is our belief that because, considering the scope, considering the actual documents that were requested, there was no actual, any of these documents being produced wouldn't have actually changed the testimony presented at the evidentiary hearing. And for that reason alone, the subpoenas don't need to be enforced today. Second issue for this court on this writ of mandamus is, should this court set aside the findings of fact originally created at the evidentiary hearing for the writ of attachment? Much of Judge Smith's court's decision to deny the writ of attachment was actually based on the fact that the petitioner, or the plaintiff, had abandoned her personal property and the real property before defendants had reached possession, had taken possession of the real property, and with the real property, everything inside of it. The court at that moment in time had to believe that there was a probably valid claim by the petitioner. However, after hearing evidence, and this was with the petitioner sitting on the stand under penalty of perjury, and petitioner, I believe, had 2 other witnesses with her, after hearing all this evidence, these objective facts that there was destroyed windows and entrances that were completely open and just genuinely uninhabitable conditions, the court made an objective decision. It said that there's no way anyone was living in this property. It weighed the credibility of the witnesses.
This is all on the attachment hearing. All this is
all on the attachment hearing.
So I understand your argument that it's up to the judge and it's discretionary on the attachment. I get that. How can he, though, grant summary judgment on the conversion claim? Aren't there genuine issues of material fact? I mean, there's been no trial held. Tell me about that piece of the case.
I understand. Just so we're clear, though, there's findings of fact. The judge is allowed to make findings of fact during the writ of attachment hearing when it's right. deciding on its probably valid
right.
assessment. The court then utilized, well, at my request, upon filing the, it's actually a motion to dismiss. It was a motion to dismiss the first amended complaint, but because we're looking at more than the 4 corners of the pleading, it's an MSJ. But in my request to the court, it was very clear that there were findings of fact that could not be ignored from the evidentiary hearing. I was not pointing to conclusions of law at the evidentiary hearing, just findings of fact that were based on testimony that was elicited at the time of the hearing. The court heard it, and both sides had the opportunity to present arguments and direct and cross the witnesses. Just because the petitioner doesn't enjoy or doesn't like the testimony that was elicited doesn't take away from the fact that everything was presented in front of the court, and that's a valid finding of facts that the court had then used during its motion to dismiss / MSJ to make its final decision on the conversion claims.
But here's the problem I have, and tell me if I'm wrong. Okay, the standard of review on summary judgment is there any genuine issues of material fact? It's not conflicting evidence like a trial would be. What you're describing is a trial where the judge can believe your client over the other, the petitioner here. On a summary judgment, a petitioner just has to say, or an opponent, that it's my property, it's valuable, it was disposed of without my permission, and I'm entitled to damages for it. And that, doesn't that create an issue of fact where you have to have that type of proceeding in a trial? That's why I asked if this attachment hearing was a trial and an attachment hearing, or was it just an attachment hearing?
It was just an attachment hearing, immediately, okay. Your Honor.
You see my problem?
I do understand your problem, and we are supposed to take the non-moving party's assertions as true. Mm-hmm. However, it doesn't mean we have to take all assertions as true if there's no reason or no credibility behind those assertions.
But isn't credibility for a trier of fact, though not for a hearing on a summary judgment motion?
That is correct, Your Honor. But in front of the trier of fact were photographs from the property that were properly authenticated during the actual hearing itself.
And now, counsel argued that they disappeared or something. What's the story on the photographs?
I believe counsel's arguing that the photographs, the actual digital versions of the photographs taken on the camera, have been deleted. To my knowledge, I think they were deleted. I think that was testimony in trial itself. And they were deleted sometime after the move-in, and I think it was before the request for them to be preserved, but they were stored on the computer and printed out at one point in time, and so all my copies are based on those printouts.
Okay.
Now, if we could go on to the third issue, which is, should this court issue the writ of attachment? Now, I've already argued to this court that there was no probably valid claim, so the argument, the analysis ends there, because without the probably valid claims, how could the court move on to, if the defendants were essentially trying to reach judgment proof status by moving assets? However, petitioner is essentially claiming that Judge Smith never actually heard or listened to or even thought about this issue of moving assets. That's blatantly untrue. It was petitioner's burden at that time to put it on the record and to bring sufficient evidence so the court could think that the defendants were moving assets. We had the custodian of records there. His name is Andy Pham. He's also listed as a defendant in this case. Mr. Pham was questioned, and Mr. Pham stated that all the money was being held by Debt Commercial Properties from all the sales. All the money was there. There was no further questions as to where the money was. Counsel refused to probe further and bring up the argument. In addition, there was also issues with the actual value being proposed. I believe it was $50,000, and the petitioner very clearly admitted she came up with those numbers in her head. She had no basis in reality for creating those numbers. Some of it was based on sentimental value. Some of it was based on the value of when she purchased the property as compared to when it was actually sold. So the court was presented with essentially a mess in front of it and made its decision on the probable claim rather than having to go into this other analysis that was unnecessary at that point in time.
Okay. What about this bond issue that opposing counsel said that there was some sort of legal aid certificate or whatever? Is there any law? I'm not familiar with that exemption to the bond requirement. Do you have any comment on that?
There is a certificate. I don't deny that. However, I did some research into it, and I couldn't find anything that pushes that forward, that says that no bond has to be posted. But that's not to say it doesn't exist. That's just I have not found anything.
Now, this legal aid, was this a finding to waive costs, court costs, or I'm not sure what the reference is. Did you apply to what's that called when you form a pauper?
Yeah. That's what the district court down in the 8th is doing now. Is a certificate. It's in their 8th JD rules that if they have a form from legal services, the costs are waived.
Okay. So it relates to court costs and all like that.
Correct.
But you're not aware of anything where it would waive a bond for a writ of attachment,
though. That's my understanding, that a bond is separate from a cost.
Okay.
However, I'm not the end-all on this one because I don't know for myself. But I would love to see more briefing on there and the actual mm-hmm. case law behind it. And so the last issue for this court is, should it set aside the actual motion to dismiss slash MSJ? I think perhaps the strongest reasoning behind denying this request, this fourth request, is the fact that there are other remedies available. There is a plain, speedy, and adequate legal remedy, which is the appeal process.
Which is what? What's that?
Which is the appeal process.
Well, that's why we're here, aren't we?
It's my understanding that a writ of attachment will not be, not a writ of attachment, I apologize, a writ of mandamus, considering its extraordinary relief, will not typically be granted when there is an adequate remedy at law. Now, I have referenced a case called Rolf Jensen v. 8th Judicial District Court of the State. In that case, the court actually did say that there was no adequate legal remedy at that point in time, and it actually seems to go against my case right now. However, there's one thing to acknowledge in the Rolf Jensen case as opposed to today's case. In Rolf Jensen, that was a matter for, it was an MSJ. The plaintiff was requesting a writ of mandamus be ordered to force the court to issue the writ of mandamus and to issue the summary judgment motion. And the reasoning was that it was largely a legal, not factual argument. It was essentially if a federal law preempted a state law. In the case that we have today, it's very different. It's actually very light on the facts.
Now, did the motion for summary judgment, did the judge adjudicate all claims on that when he granted it, or was it a partial summary judgment?
Partial. He left open trespass and declaratory relief.
Okay.
Which I argue would require 54B certification for the other two claims, and then could have been pursued via the appeal process, not a writ of mandamus. That is all the time I have.
Did that Rule 54B change, so can you still do that?
You can still. I've done it myself.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to clear up a few things that defense counsel said. Judge Smith denied the motion to quash. It's in the order. I believe it's Exhibit 26 to the writ of mandamus. The motion to quash was denied. So the subpoenas, he deemed some of them overbroad and over the top, but not all of them. And so our position is that he should have narrowed the scope then or restricted them to the ones that were not overbroad.
Did you request reconsideration of that in terms of what you know?
I did not. When we got there, he said, we're here, we'll do the hearing instead. So on that, defense counsel to date still, as we just heard, is not arguing the correct standard of abandonment, which Judge Smith should have applied in both the writ of attachment hearing and the hearing on the motion for summary judgment. Because it doesn't look like you or I would want to live there, there are plenty of people in this state that live in conditions that are below maybe what our standards are. And it's not for us to determine that just because they are poorer than us that they deem their property abandoned. She was in the process of moving that weekend as she knew the house was in foreclosure and was going to be sold. In fact, she had left a note on the front door saying, please call before you do anything. And that was ignored.
What was the basis of your 56F request? Like, did Judge Smith say, well, what do you want to continue?
I wanted to do discovery around the sole basis for granting the motion for summary judgment and the writ of attachment. The sole evidence was those pictures that defendants changed the date they were taken. If the pictures were taken on the 29th, then defendant's story is probably true. If they were not taken on the 29th, though, then Aurora's story is more likely to be true because it all lined up with how the three witnesses at the evidentiary hearing testified.
Were there other representations in favor of the 56F that you made besides the pictures?
I wanted to do on defendant Andy Pham's personal liability. He started 57 entities within the state of Nevada, and I wanted to do discovery on whether he was commingling. At that point, we'd been restricted in our ability to present any evidence on the assets owned. Part of the evidentiary hearing was to determine if a writ of attachment should issue if defendants were disposing of property. After we filed the writ of attachment, defendants disposed of the final property they owned. And they only kept the money in the bank because at the hearing to schedule the evidentiary hearing, Judge Smith asked them not to dispose of any money. Defendants did not produce any other, the documents I was trying to subpoena would have shown the assets. And if they had sufficient assets, then that claim would have been eradicated. The only claim then out of the causes of action that Aurora had was on conversion. Judge Smith did not have the authority at the evidentiary hearing to rule on the unlawful eviction, which defendants have admitted to doing because they have admitted to not posting a 3-day notice, or the unlawful entry. The only basis to dismiss a claim would have been the conversion claim, if any. But it is our position that that type of hearing is not dispositive on any issue. It is only to determine if the conversion claim is probably valid. If not,
relating to your attachment.
Yes,
request.
Relating to the attachment, yes. If not, the writ should not issue. If it is, then the writ should issue. If the writ issued, that doesn't automatically presume that they converted the property. It doesn't deem them liable on the conversion. So the inverse shouldn't be true. Lastly, the evidentiary hearing, Judge Smith, I believe, showed some bias towards my client in questioning her on her ability to pay the mortgage. He asked when the last time she paid the mortgage was. There was no basis for that. She'd already admitted that she hadn't paid it for several years because the house was in foreclosure.
Okay. Counsel,
thank you for your time.
Time from the court. We thank both counsel for their arguments this day on behalf of this matter. You've illuminated some issues for us. With that, this matter will stand submitted, and we are in recess until the call of the court.